After surviving the ignominy of junior high and coming to the realization that I was not an average middle-of-the-road mainstream teen, or rather, once I realized that that was a liability, I enrolled in the Interlochen Arts Academy, where I hoped to find solace and companionship.
Time down.
To break out.
It's a mess.
It's a mess.
Time to grow.
It was always a given that I'd attend the academy, since my mother was the head of the dance department, but the horrors of the junior high and a timely performance of A Chorus Line convinced me that I had to act sooner rather than later, and I entered as a freshman instead of waiting until the junior high ended and enrolling as a sophomore. There are, for good reasons, few people who attend at the academy as freshmen. The biggest is that it is a boarding school, and few 13-year-olds have the maturity to live by themselves at that tender age. I had what I thought at the time was the best of both worlds, because I could attend the academy during the day, but then I could walk across the street after the last class of the day and still get a home-cooked meal and hang out with my local friends and sleep in my own familiar bed. However, that comfort soon revealed itself as a liability. In a regular school, friendships are made during the day, at lunch or in classes. But in a boarding school, all the action happens after class, in the dorm or in one of the few social areas on campus. Since I wasn't there for any of that, I didn't have the opportunity to make many friends. There was a dorm room set aside for the few day students that attended the academy, all faculty brats, but that quickly became the Dungeons & Dragons lair, and I had learned my lesson about only spending time with geeks in junior high. That is, you are who you hang with. So I was loath to be part of that crowd. And now that I wasn't going to the junior high with my other local friends, those relationships started unraveling too. And I found myself, more often than not, sitting home alone during the evenings, staring wistfully out the window, and wondering if my life was ever going to begin. I longed to be part of the social scene, to have cool friends, but I just didn't know how to go about it. I was painfully shy, and the worst part of each day, the moment I dreaded most, was lunch, when I'd be thrust, tray in shaky hands, into the full flock of the student body. I'd pray for an empty table so I wouldn't have to try to insinuate myself into some established clique, but then I'd sit by myself, miserable, watching people joke and laugh with each other, with a comfort and ease that was entirely beyond me. Because my mom taught ballet, I had a bit of an in with the dance crowd. I was taking dance classes, against her wishes, but I was still a couple of years away from being proficient enough to join the higher levels and start performing. But I did tech work for them, running the light board during performances and going on tour with them, and setting up the sound system or the portable floor or whatever needed to be done. It was grunt work, but I was happy to do it because it brought me, however tangentially, into the orbits of what I and many others considered the coolest clique on campus. Dancers were the jocks of Interlochen, only without the attitude that usually accompanies that social class, and they also counted the most beautiful girls among their ranks. There were always a handful of exceptionally pretty actresses as well, but it didn't take me long to figure out that most actresses were completely crazy. Not that dancers aren't crazy too, they're just more eat 5 pounds of ice cream and go puke it up right away crazy, and less standing on the roof screaming Shakespeare crazy. And the dancers were almost all girls of the female gender, with a few girls of the male gender thrown in. I had always gotten along better with girls than boys, and the boys that tended to be dance majors, even if they weren't gay, were generally gentler and more sensitive than the average hormone-addled teenage guy. Lots of beautiful women and a few guys that didn't think blowing shit up was the most fun you could have. My kind of crowd. I desperately wanted to be counted among their ranks. They were generally nice to me, but I usually got the feeling that it was more out of a sense of duty to my mom than because of any of my inherent charms. I felt like a slightly patronized younger brother. Someday soon, this world would be mine, but for now I'd have to sit on the sidelines and watch. I idolized them, and when I was a freshman, the one I idolized the most was Rory. Rory was one of those ridiculously talented guys who was seemingly born knowing how to do more than you could ever hope to learn in a lifetime. And to top it off, he was really nice and fun to be with, so you couldn't even take any pleasure in being jealous of him. He had come to the academy as a music major, but after he broke some girl's arm playing volleyball, somebody suggested he might want to take a dance class to help him blow off some of his excess energy. He thought that sounded like a good idea, enrolled in level 1, and within 2 years had made it to the top of the heap, level 4, where he was the undisputed best dancer in the school. That kind of rise isn't just unlikely, it's impossible. Most dancers in level 4 had been studying since they could walk, and I took justifiable pride in gaining entrance to those hallowed classes after only 3 years of study, but I was nowhere near what Rory was able to achieve in only a few months, and never would be. He took the dance like the proverbial watery fish and could seemingly master every combination on the first try. Pirouettes? How many do you want? 4? 5? 6? Double tour? No sweat. To the feet or to the knee? How about a triple? And the mark of a true master, he made it all look so maddeningly easy. It was as if gravity didn't really apply to him in the same way, like he was on the moon and the rest of us were earthbound. He could sail across the stage like a kite and barely break a sweat. So effortless was his dancing, in fact, that only other dancers were truly impressed by it. It looked so easy that only those of us who'd beat ourselves to death trying to duplicate it could appreciate the stunning agility and technique he possessed. One of the most remarkable things I've ever seen him do was in a dress rehearsal. We were in Corson Auditorium, the main performance space on campus, and I was high up in the back of the hall, manning the light board and running through the pieces with the other techs, trying to get the music and the lights and the curtain and everything working together, while the dancers tried to adjust to performing on a stage with a giant black pit in front of them. We We got everything set up for the next piece. The dancers took their places. The stage manager barked into the headsets. I pushed the lights up, and Rory came exploding out onto stage, performing a complex and difficult combination full of leaps and spins that took him from one side of the stage to the other. Then we hit some sort of technical glitch and had to stop and start again. I reset the lights, and in the booth next to me, the sound guy rewound the tape to the beginning, but he did it without turning the volume down, so you could hear the tape rolling backwards at double speed. Without missing a beat, Rory performed the opening sequence backwards in double time in order to get back to his starting position. It was just a little throwaway joke, but it was one of the most amazing physical feats I've ever witnessed. That was Rory in a nutshell. He and I got to be fairly good friends, to the point that he invited me to stay with him for a couple days in New York City that summer. I jumped at the chance, both to stay in touch with him and to get a chance to see the magical, mystical New York City for myself. I had been there a couple of times as a kid, but always under close supervision. I was anxious to see the city on my own terms, even if those terms were those of a green 15-year-old from the woods of northern Michigan. Rory was very gracious and showed me around the city a bit. I'm not talking about the Statue of Liberty or the Empire State Building. Any rube with a tour book can find those things. I'm talking about taking me down into the village, he lived on the east side in the 30s somewhere, and getting me a slice of the original Ray's pizza. He and his girlfriend Jane were dead broke and spent what little money they had on taking dance classes, so our sightseeing consisted mostly of walking around the city for hours, which really is the perfect thing to do in New York. So varied and interesting are the goings-on of that giant metropolis. He introduced me to the subway system, showed me roughly the areas you wanted to avoid, which at that point was anything south of Houston, anything north of Central Park, and all the other boroughs, and turned me loose. I'd walk around while they were in class and meet them for lunch, or wander the streets so they could have sex. It was a typically microscopic New York apartment, one room with a tiny bathroom and a kitchenette. I didn't have much money, so I couldn't really go shopping, but I did break down and buy myself a record at Sam Goody's. Years later, I would recoil at the idea of going into Sam Goody's in the village when I was so close to so many great record stores. But hey, what did I know? Columbia Records was being unusually honorable at the time and offering a double album sampler of some of their new bands and charging something insane like $2.99 for it. Oh, with a 2-pound coat, she really thinks she's cloaked in mystery. She's acting like some character from Agatha Christie. I got a pain in my shoes and all I wanna do is dance. It's really smart. but few record companies can bear the thought of selling something for close to the cost of making it, even though it inevitably leads to people buying full-price, full-length releases from bands they otherwise wouldn't get the chance to hear.
Then she says, does it feel nice? Does it feel right? Does it feel all right? Does it feel good? Quite nice. Can you keep it up? Can you keep it up? Upright. Does it let you down? Does it let you down?
The only companies I can think of in recent memory to offer such a great deal on a sampler are two of the most honorable and ethical labels around, Peter Gabriel's Real World and Robert Fripp's Discipline Global Mobile.
Snap me in your breech, I wanna be a bullet. I want a little kiss that's gonna take my breath away. Never eat a leather, try to do things in a different way.
Anyway, Exposed, as it was called, was packed to the gills with new bands, many in the exciting new wave genre that was starting to heat up in the aftermath of punk. As is often the case with samplers, especially from large multinational corporations, there was a fair amount of dross from forgettable musicians that never went anywhere. But if you dug through the chaff, there were a few germs of tasty goodness, and that purchase, and the subsequent Exposed 2, got me to go into my wallet for full-length releases by the Psychedelic Furs, good call, Adam and the Ants, better call, and Jojo Zepp and the Falcons. Not so much. But my favorite track on those early compilations was a spooky noir wave track called Bates Motel from some group of British unknowns called The Hitmen. The Hitmen dropped two albums into the inky world of obscurity before being swallowed up by consumer and label apathy. Their first, Aim for the Feet, is a pretty pedestrian affair. Get it? Feet? Pedestrian? Okay songs, terrible production. But their second, Torn Together, produced by veteran Rhett Davies, Roxy Music, Ice House, is a masterpiece. It is one of my top 10 vinyl albums that were never re-released on CD. Bates Motel is the lead-off track and sets the mood for the album perfectly. A little rain, the echo of a siren, a spooky horror show organ creeping up your spine, and then the band kicks in. Vocalist Ben Watkins drags out a somewhat dated, croaky David Bowie voice for the atmospheric lyrics, which blur the line between fantasy, reality, obsession, and the filmed portrayal of all three. The song has a glorious sound to it, murky but razor-sharp, subdued and threatening during the verses, exploding into the choruses. And there's the fantastic middle section, my favorite part of the song, which shatters into layers of overlapping guitars and an insistent repeating refrain.
Oh, man.
After the explosion, the song settles down and drifts away, still menacing, like a thunderhead that's passed overhead and is off to terrorize another town. It's a stunningly sophisticated piece of music, with many layers of meaning, both lyrical and musical, and a wondrous arrangement that mixes raw walls of murky noise with delicate touches of metal frosting. An absolute knockout. Bates Motel is hands down the best thing on Torn Together, but that doesn't mean the rest of the album sucks. Far from it. Side 1, in particular, is very strong all the way through, including standouts like Picking Up the Pulse and Score It Blue. Side 2 starts off strong with the 1-2 punch of Hard Heartbeat and Don't Speak with the Enemy. But then peters out until it finally collapses under the ornate weight and overproduction of the lugubrious Comfort Me. Of course, my love of the Hitmen was received with the same kind of lukewarm response among my friends that my musical passions always received. A vague, oh, yeah, interesting, as they smiled patronizingly in that don't make any sudden moves way, and turned back to their Eagles or Kris Kristofferson or Grease soundtrack. And, as usual, I was the weirdo, because apparently nobody else thought they were at all interesting, and they have drifted completely off the map. But there is a happy ending of sorts for them. After the Hitmen disappeared into the murky waters of obscurity, one of their founding members, Ben Watkins, retooled himself for the new music scene and came out with a bushel of enticing dance tracks under the rubric Juno Reactor, which has to rank as one of the more remarkable musical reinventions in recent history. In fact, so different are their sounds that I was ready to assume it was a different Ben Watkins. it may be, until I noticed former Hitmen guitarist Pete Glenister making a guest appearance on one of the albums. Juno Reactor is my kind of dance outfit. The tracks are lushly produced and have a vague science friction to them that gives them a futuristic edge, so much so that they were tapped to provide some of the music for a couple of the Matrix films. They embrace that which most dance outfits avoid, emotional drama. Their melodramatic soundtracks may be a bit over the top at times, but you can't fault them for being too cool and detached. This is sweaty, fiery rave music to whip the savage id into a foamy frenzy. But I digress. Columbia's Exposed experiment worked for me, and for every track I liked that didn't encourage me to pick up a whole new album, like Tommy Two Tone's winning Which Man Are You, which was then trumped by the overplaying of their one semi-hit, Jenny, there was another one that did, Go Gary Murick, and their $2.99 gambit made me pour at least $30 back into the corporate coffers, money that would have probably been spent elsewhere. The next year, I was still a day student, and although my mom had encouraged me to try to get more involved in the campus life, I felt like such an imposter hanging out there after dinner and not having anywhere to go and cruising the cafeteria with no safe port in which to land. I had kept up a superficial friendship with Rory throughout that year, but we never really spent any time together because we had entirely different classes, and then he was off doing his thing at night, and I wasn't. Tonight. At graduation that year, his graduation, I got my first taste of what life might be like if I could just somehow come out of my shell and join the rest of the student body. Early in the year, I had written a short essay about the crazy interlocking schedule. Classes ran from Tuesday through Saturday, but Thursday was a kind of a floating day in which not every class met, but it was a chance to do things that were too time-consuming for the normal schedule, which, with 9 hours of classes every day running from 8:15 to 5:15, was already packed to the gills. The essay had gained some notoriety among the faculty, and the director read it, although, with my blessing, he didn't credit it to me, at Honors Convocation, the big awards celebration that took place the night before graduation. Much to my surprise, Rory latched on to me that night, and when I admitted I had written that essay, he cheered and hugged me and ran around telling everybody how cool I was. It was a wonderful night, and I finally felt like I belonged. Oh, but tonight, it's really magical. Tonight we're just alone. The next day, graduation, was a bittersweet day for everybody. Commencement took place in the morning, and then the student body slowly blew apart, parents dragging their cheerful kids away from their best friends forever. I ran into Rory early in the day, and we promised we'd hook up again before he had to leave. But alas, it was never meant to be. We got separated, and by the time I got back to his dorm, he was gone. I was devastated.
It's in strange situations that dreams are made. Just a look and they taunt you again.
Occasionally, I'll walk around with some emotional bomb in my throat, and I know if I utter the words, the floodgates will open, but if I stay quiet, I can keep the tears in check. After realizing that I had missed him and would, in all likelihood, never get to see him again, I walked slowly back across the post-apocalyptic campus towards my house, holding the poisonous phrase on my tongue, rolling it around in my mouth, feeling its weight.
Comfort me. Comfort me.
I opened the door and sat heavily on the couch. My mom came in, saw my distress, and asked what was wrong. Rory left, I muttered, letting it drop out of my mouth and onto the floor, and I didn't even get to say goodbye. The frustration of years of loneliness poured out of my head and down my cheeks, and after the storm had passed, we sat and talked for a long time, deciding that the only way I was ever really going to have the kind of friendships I wanted at the academy, those deep and meaningful relationships that I longed for and that Rory brushed against, was if I moved into the dorm for my last 2 years.
Comfort me, she looks right through me to another face. Her smile on the rise from another time and place. Can't you feel my tears? But she couldn't take.
After the summer had passed, I packed my records up in a box. Those were the days. One box held them all. Threw my clothes and sheets into the car and had my mom drive me the half mile to the dorm.
It's in strange situations that dreams are laid. Just a thought and they haunt you again. If you'd known how it felt, would it be the same? If you'd entered that once promised land.
My mom bid me farewell and drove home alone, her own poisonous phrase squeezing tears out of her eyes and into Frank's arms. My baby's gone.
Comfort me. Comfort me. Another mile, a motorway. Another line's got a hold on me. I should feel good, I don't feel good. Why don't want to be in these days? Another fight with the drum machine. Another page from a torn out team. The bottom's fighting me up and up, and I don't feel top of the empire state. You sign me up.
The first week was a blur of starting classes and buying books and auditioning and trying to get settled, and though still shy, I knew nobody really had an advantage over me, and I kept my eye out for potential friends. It wasn't long before I found one. It was one of the first nights, and I had gone down to the dance building, stomach all a butterfly, to audition for the higher level dance classes. Levels 1 and 2 you could just sign up for, but you had to audition to get into 3 or 4, and your placement was dependent on the teacher's evaluation. It was a tense process because, in addition to the stress of auditioning, most people built their schedule around the assumption that they were getting into a particular level, And if they didn't, not only would tears be shed, but then you'd have to go through a mad scramble trying to get your schedule all worked out. I knew the dance teachers very well, one being my mom, after all, and had gone through the first two levels with them, but two didn't necessarily lead into three, and many hopefuls were turned away. It was a common situation at Interlaken, a double-edged sword. Most of the students who came there were the best in their school or community at whatever they did, be it acting or music or dance or writing or painting or whatever. On one hand, it was often a relief for those people to come to a community in which their passion, that which had branded them a hopeless outsider at home, was encouraged. But invariably, those that were the best in West Elbow, Nebraska, were in for a rude awakening when they found themselves to be merely mediocre in this new, rarefied context. Many dancers, and musicians, and so on, were shocked and discouraged to suddenly find themselves not at the top of the ladder, but at the bottom of a much higher ladder. So anyway, there I was at the auditions, greeting old acquaintances, many of whom were surprised but encouraging to find me there, and checking out the new meet, nervously warming up and staring googly-eyed around the room. One newcomer I didn't recognize was a boy named Troy, or at least that's what was emblazoned across his tank top in giant red letters. The teachers came in looking official and serious, greeted everybody solemnly, and told them to find places at the bar, and auditions began.
She's got the holes in her star case that she never tried to hide. And the once was all she kissed me. It's been a thousand times of doubt. Yes, she loved to hear the nocturne.
I did what I could, I tried my best, and, although I was clearly out of my league in some aspects, I thought I did all right. But it wasn't up to me. Even though I had an insight in the department, I knew they weren't going to cut me any slack and that I'd have to wait for the list to be posted the next day, just like everybody else. So I went back to the dorm and took a shower. Trying to take a proactive stance to making friends, I forced myself out of my room. I was, ironically, the only person in the dorm who didn't have a roommate, and wandered the halls, seeing what I could see, making myself available. Going through the basement, I poked my head into the laundry room and saw Troy washing out his tights. He smiled, I smiled and said hello, and I walked in to chat. It was one of those moments that I look back on as a life-changing event, like feeling a stranger's hands on my tense neck at college years later, or getting a message to call the sheriff's office in Kodiak years after that. His name, as it turned out, wasn't Troy, it was Eric. Troy was the suburb of Detroit from which he hailed. He was well-built, with beefy arms and the kind of broad shoulders that girls, and lots of guys, were suckers for. He had brown hair and a very open and friendly face, and although I didn't really see it at the time, still don't, frankly, sorry dude, He was apparently classically beautiful, a feature that would actually land him on the pages of GQ years later. He was friendly and easy to talk to, and we both got along very well, and from almost that moment on, we were inseparable. He and I both made it into level 3 that year and became roommates and danced together for a couple of years and lived together for a couple more, becoming so close that people didn't know which of us was which. We were Eric and Chris, or Chris and Eric, one entity with two names. I had never met anybody like him, and I still haven't. I've heard people describe the concept of a soulmate, one who is indelibly a part of you, one without whom life pales. In many ways, Eric was one of the great loves of my life. I felt such a comfort around him, and we both grew so much in each other's light, exploring our darker, scurrier sides with the knowledge that the other was right there beside us. When we lived together with Bruce in New York City and would meet him at one of his gay bar hangouts, Eric and I would always unquestioningly become each other's lover while we were in that world. It wasn't a suppressed sexual longing so much as just a knowledge and a comfort that we really did love each other, and that was a beautiful thing. We've been through many things together, some good, some bad, and we don't get to spend nearly enough time with each other now that he lives 1,000 miles away, or is it me that lives 1,000 miles away? But when we do see each other, the distance evaporates instantly, and we're right back where we were last time, arm in arm, heart in heart. Moving into the dorm was the best thing I did that year, because it finally opened me up to the kind of friendship I craved, and my relationship with Eric still stands as one of the absolute pinnacles of my life. And I knew early on that we were going to be good friends. How could I tell? He loved the Hitmen too.